Welcome to the Bloomberg Surveillance Podcast. I'm Tom Keene. Daily, we bring you insight from the best in economics, finance, investment, and international relations. Find Bloomberg Surveillance on Apple Podcasts, SoundCloud, Bloomberg.com, and of course, on the Bloomberg.
I'm pleased to say that Shahab Jalanu's Credit Suisse head of FX and macro trading strategy drops into the studio to help us get up to speed. Good morning to you, Shahab.
Morning.
Wednesday, what are you looking for?
So I think the market has got its head around now the idea that we're only going to get a 25 basis point cut. Just 2 weeks ago, there was a debate around this. Maybe we could have 50. But I think the issue is really, do we see indications that the market pricing for the rest of the year, there's another couple of cuts priced in, is that valid or not? And I think we'll need to see some strong language around the risks facing the global economy, for example, on trade wars or even Brexit, because the actual numbers from the US itself aren't really sufficiently bad to warrant more cuts in of themselves. So we would need to see some strong language there on the risks.
So Shahab, are you in that camp that says we have 100 basis points of cuts over the next 12 months? So are you in that camp?
So Credit Suisse's official house view actually is we only get one cut, and that's the cut that happens in July. I think from the market's perspective, it's difficult to imagine just one cut now, just because equity markets are at record highs, as already mentioned.
And do I sense some tension around the Credit Suisse house view internally?
No, there's no tension at all. it's more about where the market is, and I think where the market is at record highs based on the idea that you're going to get many cuts. So I think if the house view is correct, then the equity market it could well struggle, unless the reason is that you do get a sudden surprise shift in the trade talks front. And of course, this week we do have the US visiting China again on that front. If you did get a positive surprise in the next 2 to 3 months that eliminates that risk, then yes, that house view could work out alongside equities staying strong. Otherwise, it gets quite tricky.
So what is your view of trade? Again, we have the US delegation going over to China this week. Are you expecting anything material to come out, or maybe just kick the can down the road a little bit?
Certainly the market's baseline expectation is that the can gets kicked down the road. I think the issue there is that both sides now have defined some fairly hard lines, and caving in at this point by either side represents
potential
loss of
faith. But I thought we were 90% of the way towards a deal
May. Up until May, and then the thing got blown up. Shouldn't we just be able to start from that point, Shahab, out the last 10%?
Well, that's what the US would like, because that was the point at which the Chinese harden their lines. So I think the US would love it if we could go back to that point. The question is why the Chinese would shift to a tougher line in May simply to change again at the end of July. So I guess the market's logic is fairly sound as to why we won't get progress now. But there's a lot of positive surprise potential if we somehow did.
I'd love to know what happens in between with the foreign exchange market. Larry Kudlow ruling out currency intervention. Then hours later, the president said he hadn't ruled anything out. Then the Wall Street Journal reporting over the weekend the following. And I love this quote. There was a meeting on Tuesday. That's been confirmed. Advisors discussed several proposals, including whether to jawbone the dollar lower. This according to a person familiar with the meeting. Then President Trump quickly cut off a proposal from trade advisor Peter Navarro, under which the White House would have attempted to reduce the inflation-adjusted value of the US dollar by 10%. This is Wall Street Journal reporting. But Shahab, let's not gloss over the fact that this meeting actually happened on Tuesday in the White House to discuss how to weaken the US dollar. What are you telling clients about that at the moment?
So what we've thought about this for a while is that the focus on this issue is likely to increase as we go into next year, which is obviously a presidential election year in the US. And this means that even though interest rate differentials continue to favor the US dollar against the rest of the G10, it probably means that the dollar's already peaked in this cycle. Because as we approach new highs for the dollar, the market will keep in mind a heightened risk that some kind of intervention at least took will materialize, but maybe even action as well. And you see that even in things like the FX options markets, where you can see that the market is beginning to pay more of a premium for out-of-the-money dollar puts than dollar calls, for example, against the euro. So some signs are beginning to emerge that the market is wanting to buy protection for outsized dollar moves lower.
So we've heard peak dollar I've heard it for 6 months here. I'm just not sure against what the dollar depreciates. I look at the euro, I look at sterling, I mean, the yen. I mean, how do you, what would be the catalyst in your mind?
Well, the catalyst, there's a couple of catalysts. Firstly, substantial Fed rate cuts that narrow rate differentials. We weaken the dollar across the board. So you've mentioned a number of different currencies there. Broadly speaking, the dollar could fall against a basket of all of those if the Fed cuts enough. Intervention would do the same thing. Maybe it would only be a temporary effect initially.
Yeah.
But again, it would simply undermine the dollar against a broad swath.
Well, Shahab, let's pick up on that first point, though. Rate differentials, the premise of that argument, why will rate differentials reassert themselves in this FX market anytime soon? Because they don't seem to be the dominant factor in exchange rate swings of the last year or so.
Well, the reason for that is that although the rate differentials have narrowed somewhat, it's still been the case that other central banks, for example, the ECB, but even as far away as Australia, New Zealand, they've all been trying to ease policy at the same time. So the market has known that, for example, you might get even more negative rates in Europe. You might get a resumption of asset purchases by the ECB.
Yeah.
And these things mean that you don't really get the benefit of seeing your rate differentials tightened against the US because the market's still expecting more things from you as well.
What do you make of the fact that the BOJ is not part of this discussion right now? The Bank of Japan meets this week. Hardly anybody is talking about action from the BOJ. Are you thinking about action from the BOJ?
I think we have to think about it. But what's holding the BOJ back, in my view, is that the level of the dollar against the yen is still reasonably high. We haven't seen a significant meltdown in that exchange rate, for example, over the past 12 months. So the disinflationary forces that could come in if the yen were to rally a lot against the dollar, they've not come through yet. So I think the BOJ is trying to keep its ammo dry for the time being, simply because it also doesn't have that much more it can do at this point, given it already has negative rates, yield curve control, a bunch of other things in play as well. So we could see more, but maybe we have to wait for a much lower dollar yen rate first.
Hey, Shahab, great to catch up with you. As always, Shahab Jalanous there, Credit Suisse Head of FX and Macro Trading Strategy. I'm really pleased to say that Terry Haynes joins us now, Pangea Policy Advisor, refounder. Terry, great to have you with us on the program. Just walk me through your expectations as high-ranking officials leave Washington today and head towards Shanghai.
My pleasure to be here, John. Thank you. My expectations is that very little happened. I think what you saw out of the G20 is that both leaders in both countries really want the illusion of progress more than actual progress. I continue to say that what I think we get is a kind of a cold peace between the United States and China on trade into 2020. I mean, we are now in the second half of this year, but you're not going to get a comprehensive deal wrapped up. And to me, the greatest sticking point remains the enforceability of the deal, something that China appeared to be willing to do as up until about last May and then pulled back. I mean, clearly, I think something happened there, but now they don't want an enforceable deal, and that's something the United States has always wanted. So until there's enforceability, there's no deal.
So Terry, it seemed a couple of months ago that both sides were on the cusp of a deal. Was that just an illusion?
I think it was not an illusion, Paul, based largely upon statements from both sides at the time. I think Kudlow's statement sticks out to me because he said something like we were on the 7-yard line, and I think that's fair. I mean, they were certainly inside the 10, but what they pulled back from, in my estimation, and China pulled back from specifically, was enforceability. And all of a sudden, the idea that, from the Chinese perspective, the idea that a deal should be enforceable was a violation of sovereignty, and follow the bouncing ball with that. Every trade deal, in order to be enforceable, I mean, the United States, Europe, anywhere, Korea, anywhere, involves changing your own country's laws in order to comply with the trade deal. So, the idea that trade deals somehow are a violation of sovereignty, I think simply doesn't wash if you look at it. you know, clearly they want a slow roll here for whatever reasons. So, this is why I say that I think the moment that China is willing to actually abide by an enforceable deal, they can get one from the United States.
Right. So, Terry, do you think, is it your sense that the time has passed for these two sides to get together? We might just have to wait till after the 2020 election?
No, I don't think so, Paul. I think that's a very good question, but I don't think so. I think that there are a lot of challenges that China faces today. They face, in no particular order, they face the Hong Kong challenge. They face concerns about trade overall. They face concerns with Belt and Road and whether they're trying to wrap people up in debt. There are concerns about Chinese equities, bank failures, so on and so forth. There's an awful lot of concerns here. But I think the trajectory has been, over the past year and a half or so, has been that both countries realize that what they need to be doing is concluding a deal. And I think that eventually happens. I just don't think it happens in the remaining 5+ months of this year.
And Terry, how big is Huawei just as a feature of these talks this week from the Chinese side?
I think it's a fairly big factor from the Chinese side. I think that it is a red herring to suggest from the American side that much is available on a compromise. You know, there are two very different kinds of issues here, John. One kind of issue is whether or not American companies can continue to sell to Huawei. The other issue is, and that's very much within the president's control and within the president's ability to do. The other one is not so much. This fundamental concern about whether or not Huawei itself or other similar Chinese telecom companies are national security risks is not really something the president can give away, not least because to do so, he'll alienate the entire national security apparatus of the United States. So I think there's incremental moves available to Huawei on the Huawei supply issue to help mitigate the problem from the Chinese perspective. But if the Chinese or anybody else are expecting a reversal from the United States on Huawei overall, I think they're dreaming, frankly.
So, Terry, one of the things I try to do, and I think a lot of investors try to get a sense of, is which side needs a deal more? And one of those issues that you have to get a handle on is the tariffs. What impact do you think the tariffs are having on the Chinese?
I think they have a bit higher impact on the Chinese than they do on the United States, frankly. The difficulty with the tariffs from the Chinese perspective is that it's forcing the pace and forcing the decisions on things that they would prefer to have happen naturally. I mean, this whole idea that they're going to move out of and somewhat away from heavy industry and the like, and let that go to other countries. The pace of that is being forced by the tariff issues as more and more countries decide that they're going to move their facilities to Vietnam, to some other third country, and that's a problem. Combined with all the other, that is not an overweening problem, but combined with all the other problems that I mentioned earlier, it's significant, and it certainly contributes materially to a slowdown.
So far, just as far as Hong Kong is concerned, Terry, the White House hasn't asserted itself very strongly over the last couple of months as these protests have continued. The Chinese have warned Hong Kong that the unrest has gone far beyond peaceful protests now. And I just wonder how you think this will escalate in the coming weeks.
I say two things about that, John. One is that I think, since we're pivoting from trade on this, let me talk and say as far as the trade goes, trade is not... Hong Kong is not something that will stop the United States from making a deal. So in that sense, it's not a negative, but it's also not a positive. The United States is not going to be, overly inclined to bend over backwards with a country that's widely perceived, not just in the United States, but far beyond, as having a serious problem with its own citizenship based on human rights and constitutional rights and in the one country, two systems, and the basic law and all the rest. So there's that. My view of the Hong Kong business, though, is that clearly, and you've foreshadowed this, is clearly the Chinese government, in supporting Carrie Lam, is giving Ms. Lam's government a bit of an ultimatum. They chose not to say anything in an official press conference from the Hong Kong Macau office about options available. But firstly, it was made apparent yesterday that should the Hong Kong government wish to call upon the People's Liberation Army garrison there, they could do so. Second, I think a little bit more worrisome generally is that you've got the People's Daily editorializing today that the time has come for forceful action. So what you're likely to see here is a huge pushback from the government in a way that doesn't end well. The other thing I would say is just very briefly,
just quickly, Terry.
Yeah, is from the medium to longer term. Does this mark a moment where the Chinese want to take Hong Kong down a notch and really move towards Shanghai as a world financial center?
Yeah. Terry, we've got to leave it there. Great to catch up with you and get your thoughts. Terry Haynes there of Pangea Policy Advisory.
Geopolitics continues to be a key factor in global financial markets, whether it is the Mideast with Iran or Asia in Hong Kong. To get the latest on some of these key topics, we turn to Admiral James Stravitis. Admiral Stravitis is a Bloomberg Opinion columnist. He's also a Carlyle Group advisor and, of course, a former Supreme Allied Commander at NATO. Admiral, thank you so much for joining us this morning. I wonder if we could start with Iran. Tensions there seem to be ramping up, and it seems like we're just one mistake away from something serious happening. What is your sense of what's going on there?
Precisely that. We have entered a red zone of miscalculation. In other words, thus far in this controversy, we have not seen anybody get killed. We've seen drones shot down. We've seen explosions on tankers. We've seen the U.S. come within the press of a button by the president effectively to launch a counterstrike. But so far, Paul, no one's been killed. That, unfortunately, is where we are trending as the summer heats up. And having commanded ships at multiple levels in the Arabian Gulf, I can tell you those crews are getting tired, they're stressed, they're on watch, and this is on both sides, both U.S. and Iranian. So the key here is to keep all of the forces that we have in the Gulf on high level of alert, but keep them mentally in a position to avoid escalating the conflict. That's a tricky path to walk.
So, Admiral, is it your sense that is the next move most likely to come from Iran, per se, that whether they want to ratchet tensions up or maybe pull back? Because it's very difficult to kind of predict their behavior.
Unfortunately, I think they will ratchet it up, and they have very few non-inflammatory tools left. They're just under crushing economic pressure. I don't need to tell a Bloomberg audience that. And it is causing them to lash out, to get attention, and to hope to get concessions by demonstrating to the West that they can control the Strait of Hormuz. So now that they've seized a tanker, pretty much the only thing left is to actually attack a warship, British or U.S., or to actually sink a tanker, or to horizontally escalate and use, for example, Hezbollah to strike into Israel, to attack our troops in Afghanistan, where they have a very strong presence in Western Afghanistan. So there are very few escalatory moves left. And unfortunately, I would say this one is going to get worse before it gets better.
Admiral, what do you believe at this point the U.S. strategy and or policy is as it relates to Iran right here?
What it should be is working with our allies, partners, and friends to broaden this thing and get it out of a U.S. versus Iran channel and get it into world versus Iran. And I commend Secretary of State Pompeo, who's been on foot patrol, particularly around the NATO allies, and we just see the British sending an additional frigate. We know now that the Italians, the Germans, and the French are all committed to sending warships into the Gulf to do the kind of escort duty that'll be necessary to keep the strait open. So expanding this should be our policy, and it appears to be what we're doing.
And just, Admiral, you've had so much experience in that part of the world. Just give us a sense of what it's like to sail in those waters under these conditions.
Well, it's first and foremost, you feel that tension ratcheting up as you drive your ship out of the Indian Ocean and up through the Strait of Hormuz, because you're passing within 15 to 20 miles of Iranian radars, missile systems. They immediately launch patrol craft, aircraft to come overfly your ship. You then get into the Persian Gulf, and you see even more Iranian hardware on one side of the Gulf, and on the other you see the Saudis, the UAE, fishing boats everywhere, and of course the main event are these massive tankers, hundreds of thousands of tons flowing in and out. It's the most complex maritime environment in the world, and in periods of tension like this, it becomes the most dangerous.
Admiral, let's switch gears a little bit, maybe go to the other side of the globe, if you will, to Hong Kong. It seems like these protests in Hong Kong continue to have probably more legs than maybe some observers had thought initially. What is your sense of how this might play out over there?
Let's start just with the scale of these protests. Several weeks ago, 2 million protesters came out. Those are reliable estimates. This is on a population of about 7 million. So to have that level of protests in the United States, for example, would be a protest that turned out 80 or 90 million people. This is an enormous revolt, if you will, by the people of Hong Kong. How it plays out is China is increasingly worried. Yesterday, they encouraged the local Hong Kong authorities to really crack down on the protesters. China has issued statements saying that they view the events there gravely in international politics. That's normally quite a signal. So I think China has no intentions of letting this get out of control. Having said that, I don't think we're looking at Tiananmen Square 2. What I believe China will do is encourage the local authorities to effectively play rope-a-dope, to hope that it peters out over the summer, particularly, and into the fall. And they will continue marginally to support Carrie Lam, who is the administrator for the city and the territory. But I think China, again, has a red line here. They are not going to let this get out of control.
So, Admiral, are you surprised that China has taken maybe such a soft touch here, that they haven't come down even more harshly on some of these protesters?
There's one word answer to that question, and it's Taiwan. In other words, China knows that everybody in Taiwan is watching how China handles these protests. And China's long game is to consolidate Taiwan. They already, of course, believe that's part of China. What they want is to encourage Taiwan peacefully to be assimilated with China. A harsh, harsh crackdown in Hong Kong will set that effort back enormously. China knows that. So China is kind of on a slippery slope, if you will. They want to control Hong Kong, but they want to do it in a way that does not completely alienate Taiwan.
Admiral, you mentioned the red line that China may have as it relates to Hong Kong. What do you think that red line is?
I would say it would be a violent protest that kill or injure significantly authorities. The Chinese, as an authoritarian regime, have they're horrified when they see protests that turn bloody and are directed against police. I think that anything that smacked of an independence movement would be crushed instantly. The protesters have been very careful not to move in that direction. I think those would be the two red lines. One, physical, ramping up the protests with more violence, or a movement politically that would begin to bring in the idea of independence. That would be an incredible red line for China.
Admiral James Stravitis, thank you so much for joining us. Admiral Stravitis, of course, former Supreme Allied Commander at NATO and also Bloomberg Opinion columnist and Carlyle Group advisor, bringing us up to date with his very informed thoughts on some of the geopolitical issues that certainly are front and center for global investors, most notably the Middle East and the tensions rising there as it relates to Iran. Well, last week was a big week in the wireless business. T-Mobile and Sprint finally received DOJ approval, clearing a major hurdle to completing this long-awaited deal. Part of the DOJ settlement required the companies to spin off some spectrum to who other than Charlie Ergen at Dish. Now the question is, what is Mr. Ergen going to do with all this spectrum? To help us answer that question, we welcome our good friend Tara LaChapelle, Bloomberg opinion columnist covering all things TMT. Tara, thanks for coming in here and joining us. I know you spoke to Charlie Ergen last week. What'd you learn?
So we asked Charlie, you know, what is the plan about becoming a wireless provider? And he said, you know, they're trying to become a serious competitor, that they're going to start with the Boost business that they're acquiring from Sprint and T-Mobile. And that from there, they're going to try to build a 5G network and eventually become a big wireless carrier. And we asked him, you know, how are you going to do that? Are you perhaps underestimating the challenge of branding Dish as a wireless provider and something that customers will see as more than just a satellite TV company? And he said, you know, the priority is just having a good network, and that from there, the branding and the reputation recognition will kind of follow.
Well, it's interesting. I mean, I'm looking at the stock. It's up 56% year to date, which kind of baffles me because, you know, to build a wireless network is not a cheap endeavor. Where's he going to get the money?
Yeah, I mean, I think he's looking for partners at this point, some deep-pocketed companies. The rumors have been around Google, Amazon, something like that, that could help him with the financial aspects of building a network and maybe some of the technological know-how, because it is such a big endeavor. And at this point, he's talked a lot about building a network, but it's been a lot of talk. You know, we haven't really seen much. So I think people are a little bit skeptical of where this is going to go, but he seems really committed to doing it.
Is he committed with all the spectrum he has? It's not just the spectrum he bought here from T-Mobile and Sprint, but he's been buying spectrum over the years at various auctions by the government. So he's sitting on a tremendous amount of spectrum. The question is, how does he monetize that spectrum? Initially, he was talking about, oh, we're not going to build a wireless network that's too expensive. We're just going to build some Internet of Things kind of network, which is cheaper. Has he kind of changed his tune a little bit now?
Yeah, I think so. I think he's kind of downplaying that Internet of Things idea and is thinking of Dish in the future as more of another wireless provider for consumers in the 5G space, starting with these prepaid businesses that he's inheriting through this deal.
Is there some timing here? I know there's when you buy the spectrum, oftentimes there's hurdles or deadlines that the government says, like, hey, if you're buying the spectrum, you got to build something by a certain date, and you got to show us that you're actually going to use the spectrum. Hasn't he kind of missed a bunch of those dates?
Right. So that seems to be the biggest reason for him striking this deal with Sprint and T-Mobile now, because he has this deadline approaching in March of 2020. He probably wouldn't have had everything in place by that point that he needed to in order to meet the FCC agreement. So what this deal does now is it pushes back some of those deadlines. Later in the years, it accelerates what he needs to have done. But for the next couple of years, he has a little bit more leniency as he works on building this supposed 5G network. So it definitely helps him in terms of working out something with the FCC so that he doesn't get fined or have the spectrum taken away from him.
So Charlie's a noted poker player. And
yes,
a lot of investors are saying, basically, I believe in Charlie. I believe he's going to monetize this spectrum one way or the other. Is there a concern that maybe he's overplayed his hand here, that the market's just kind of passed him by, the industry's consolidated, we don't really need his spectrum?
It's possible. I think that's one of the biggest concerns because, you know, the wireless market is such a tough market right now. It's unclear whether Dish can really disrupt the market to the point that they can get enough subscribers and kind of help keep pricing competitive and make this a really profitable business for Dish. You know, Dish has been pretty fortunate over the last couple of years that the stock valuation has been based almost entirely on these valuable spectrum licenses that he has, even though they were unused. And now with this wireless business that he's getting into, it's going to be looked at much more like the other companies, where they're looking at free cash flow, they're looking at earnings, and less so at these assets, because they're going to be deployed and it's going to be more of an operating business. And I think that may, you know, while the stock is up this year, that could hurt the stock price down the road.
So this postpaid business, that's not really a great part of the wireless business, is it?
Right. I mean, there's not a lot of growth. 5G is going to be extremely expensive in terms of just the capital required to build these networks and upgrade what's there, and also reaching rural parts of the country where 5G poses just simple technological challenges because of the way that the spectrum works. So I think, you know, there's a little bit being underestimated here. And also, again, how does Dish tell consumers we're another option out there? I think, you know, they haven't really been great at that part of branding their business, and they really need to do that in order to be a strong wireless player, because that business is based so much on advertising and promotion and discounts and things like that.
It is, yeah, it is a tough business, the wireless business. Tons of price pressure, really no loyalty among consumers, so high marketing expenses. So is really the bull play here? If I'm talking to a big bullish Charlie Ergen investor, am I going to hear something like, oh, he's just going to sell the spectrum, some technology company is going to come along and pay a big number, and that's how I'm going to get paid?
He says no, and he's not supposed to do that. But I think a lot of people will still be hoping for that. I think Dish investors still see perhaps it's less likely, but the bull case is still that he partners with some really big tech company, gets bought out in some way, and monetizes the spectrum much more quickly than building a 5G network would be.
And in the interim, the old Dish business, the satellite television business, that continues to bleed subscribers, right? So what is he saying about that business?
I mean, he's saying very little, but yeah, the satellite TV business is not doing very well for obvious reasons. And I think it's instructive what he's done with that in terms of looking at what he could do with wireless, because they own Sling TV, which is one of the first streaming services, and they really neglected that product. They didn't spend enough on marketing and really getting people to be aware of what Sling is and how great of a product it really is. So that was a big mistake. And I think maybe the part of the reason was he was trying to protect the satellite business since it's more profitable, but it meant that he was a slow mover in streaming when he had no excuse to be, and he really needs to learn a lesson from that as he enters wireless.
Is there any sense that they could merge with DirecTV? I know that was talked about at one point, maybe, but there's antitrust issues. Any chance of that happening again?
You know, we asked him about that speculation, and he said there's no reason that speculation won't persist as a result of this deal. So, I mean, he said, you know, the industrial logic is still there. Whether that means anything, we don't know, but it does make sense. You know, both of those businesses are, you know, slowly going away, and they could be more profitable together. And it does seem like AT&T, at least, is becoming a little bit less interested in the DirecTV business. So maybe something happens down the road. Right now, it looks like both companies kind of have their hands full.
Interesting. That was probably one of the worst deals I've seen in the last 10 or 15 years, AT&T buying DirecTV. It wasn't even at the peak. I think it was past the peak. They were already losing subscribers. They paid a big number, and now they have to figure out what to do with it. They've already taken a write-off there, so interesting. Tara LaChapelle, thanks so much for joining us. Tara LaChapelle, Bloomberg Opinion columnist covering all things TNT for us.
Thanks for listening to the Bloomberg Surveillance Podcast. Subscribe and listen to interviews on Apple Podcasts, SoundCloud, or whichever podcast platform you prefer. I'm on Twitter at Tom Keen. Before the podcast, you can always catch us worldwide on Bloomberg Radio.